All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, I'm Michael Slate, and you're not. Okay, and if you remember that reference, just write me and let me know, all right? There you go. Okay. At the back end of the show, we are... It's actually a really, really interesting show this week. We just stumbled onto this. Certain sense, some of it. We're going to be talking with Lawrence Torchello, who's the co-author of an open letter from academics to world leaders ahead of the Paris Climate Conference. And it's all about why people should actually take an ethical and moral stand, while there's actually an ethical and moral imperative for people to take a stand against what's being done to the climate. All right, it's going to be very interesting talking with him about that. And before that, we're going to be talking with author, filmmaker, journalist, and human rights activist Jen Marlowe, who recently wrote an article called "In Gaza, Medical Permits Are Linked to Intelligence Gathering." It's a very interesting interview I did just before, just in the middle of this week, and we're going to run it today. And it's a, well, you'll hear it. It's very good. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Sansara Taylor. And we're talking with Sansara about what's been going on in relation to the assault on abortion. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this so we get as much time as possible. On Friday, November 27th, a gunman launched an armed attack against the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, killing three people. A serious escalation of the war against women. And as was written in RevCom and on Revolution Newspaper, actually also linked to a serious escalation in the assault against all people. But in particular, Sansara, right now to start, I wanted to talk with you, and you're a writer for Revolution Newspaper, as people know, and RevCom.us, and you're also an initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, Enslavement and Degradation of Women. I wanted to talk to you about your take on this just murderous assault in Colorado Springs.
Well, I'm glad to be talking with you. We are at a time when there is an all-out emergency facing women's right to abortion. And I think we have to look at this violent, murderous assault on the Planned Parenthood in Colorado as part of this war on women. I wanted to actually share a quote which came out about a week and a half before this shooting from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, because he puts his finger right at the heart of what's going on with this struggle. He says, "Unbelievable as it may seem, in the 21st century, there are still people, including people in positions of power and authority, who are determined to force women to bear children, regardless of the situation, the feelings, and the better judgment of those women themselves. That is a way of enslaving women to the dictates of an oppressive, male supremacist, patriarchal system. And that is what the cruel fanatics who are determined to deny women the right to abortion are really all about." And the reason I thought this quote was important before, but I think it's so important because even more so now, in the wake of this shooting, you hear people talking about gun violence, and that's real. You hear people talking about how the police were able to apprehend this white murderous gunman who actually killed people and put many in the hospital and was armed to do even worse, and they were able to apprehend him without killing him, but they kill black youth all the time, and that's real, and that's important to expose. And you even hear people talking about the inflammatory rhetoric of fascist politicians. If you call abortion murder, you spread lies about Planned Parenthood. That is setting the stage for this kind of murderous rampage. All these things are important to bring up, but actually almost nobody, it's shocking, and I'm honestly a bit furious how little people are talking about, well, why are these attacks coming on abortion clinics, on abortion access, and abortion availability around the country, and yes, the violent assault, which is escalating on providers and clinics. And it has to do with what Avakian is talking about, the attempt to enslave women to the dictates of an oppressive male supremacist patriarchal system, forcing women to bear children against their will. This is about a war on women. And so I think that has to be foremost in our understanding about why this clinic was targeted, about why it is not some exception. There's escalating violence against abortion clinics, but there's also whether it happens through extra legal terror, which is very horrendous, but also if it happens through the quote unquote proper channels, the laws and regulations that restrict abortion, the result is the same. And all of it is one piece. It's a war on women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on all of that. And one of the things that really struck me too is that, one, there's this point about the going after Planned Parenthood in a way that actually, it's very heavy. I mean, it's been going on for quite a while, and all the things that have been done to sort of frame them up around different things and all. But the other thing is that this point about this not just being yet another thing in a string of assaults, that there's actually an escalation here. And it's pretty important in terms of the times that we're in and the times we're going into for people to understand that this is an escalation and to understand what it's an escalation of, because I think that's something that people don't always get either.
Yeah, I think we are living in a time on this planet, frankly, in this country, but on this planet, where the role of women is being fiercely contended. It's being battled out. Women have been treated like chattel. Women have been treated like property of men. Women have been treated as sex objects or breeders of children for literally thousands of years. This is bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, into different classes, the ruling classes and the exploited and oppressed. And it is no less true under capitalism and imperialism that women are still treated as subordinate to men. But these things have been challenged. Patriarchy has been challenged. In recent decades here and all over the world, it's been challenged in the revolutions that have been made, the communist revolutions, as well as other struggles. And those thousands of years of traditions change, they're being pulled at, and they're being forcefully reasserted in many different ways all over the planet, and here in this country, no different. And so I think we have to view what's happening with the war on abortion rights, which is also a war on birth control, which is also a war on sex education, which is at its core a war on women's full humanity, it's part of this larger fight over whether women will be seen and treated as full human beings or whether women will be forced back even more overtly to the status of property of men and breeders of children. And I think there's been a war waging for decades, actually, to restrict abortion rights ever since it was made legal in 1973 in this country. But in the last few years, it's really been unprecedented. And I think in the last year, there have been more than 50 laws passed that have closed abortion clinics and restricted access and forced women to go through mandatory waiting periods, making it more difficult to access abortion. I think at this point, a piece came out recently that calculated that an abortion clinic in this country is forced to close every week and a half, because of the laws, because of the restrictions, because of how difficult and dangerous it is to provide abortions. And this year, we're expecting, 2016, I should say, next year, we're expecting the most significant Supreme Court case that has happened in decades to actually evaluate whether a lot of these restrictions, it's focused up on a case in Texas, but it will set terms for whether these even more extreme restrictions on women's right to abortion are going to be upheld and spread and made even more pervasive across the country, or whether they'll be temporarily beaten back. And I think it's a very theocratic Supreme Court. It's a very fascist Supreme Court. It's a very dangerous moment. And so I think it would be wrong to look at this, the violence at the Planned Parenthood, in isolation to this larger backdrop of what is actually a fascist, a dark ages, biblical fundamentalist approach to re-enslaving women, which is happening from the highest offices in the land, from the halls of power, and it's unleashing a fascist foot soldier social base, whipping up the kind of rhetoric and spreading the kind of lies and demonization of Planned Parenthood and abortion providers that does set the stage for this kind of murderous assault.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to actually give people some particularities in relation to this, because even having followed this as much as I had and paid a lot of attention to it, even reading, there was something that was up in Revolution newspaper on RevCom, and revcom.us, and actually one of the things it did was it walked people through, and I don't want you to have to list everything, but I want people to get a sense of, when we talk about an escalation and this fascist assault and the dangerous assault and all this, there's a reality to, actually, you said the dangers of providing abortions, and there's a reality to what's happening against abortion clinics that's like more, it's very concrete, very real, very bullet-ridden, and very dangerous for people who, even for people who go there, people who work there, for anyone associated with it. And it's a whole string of that that's been building and building, and it's culminating in a lot of the stuff that we're seeing now, which on one hand, I want to talk about this first in terms of this kind of fascistic assault, and then I'll talk a little bit more about the Supreme Court, because I thought that was very heavy too.
Yeah, I think people should know there have been now 11 people murdered for either providing abortions or defending those who are just doing their jobs to provide abortions. There's been 11 people who've been killed, starting with Dr. David Gunn, who was the first abortion provider who was assassinated in the 90s. And the threats have continued. George Tiller survived an attempted murder, was shot in both arms. He was an abortion doctor in Wichita, Kansas. Years later, he was then shot and killed in his church while he served as an usher. If you're an abortion doctor, you are hunted. Your address, a lot of anti-abortion fanatics, they publish the home address. They publish the faces and the pictures. They go to people's homes. They hold protests at their homes. They go to their churches. They go to their places of work if they're in an office with other, like doctors who provide abortions but also have a family practice. They'll go to the other places, try to get them evicted from their landlords, all this kind of thing. And this has led to a situation where, and I think you see this in the Planned Parenthood that was assaulted. If you actually read what happened in that Planned Parenthood, and for good reasons, Planned Parenthood is not releasing all of the internal functionings, but they said that the gunman actually made it through the first security wall, but not through the second wall. They have a safe house in the clinic. They have bulletproof vests in the clinic. They had a way to lock the clinic down so that the gunman didn't get past the main lobby entrance area. Now, that's not atypical for an abortion clinic. Most abortion clinics have very, very complex security systems. They have bulletproof glass. They have locking doors within the clinic. They have bulletproof vests. They have security drills regularly. They have people defending their clinics. They have security out front. This is because they exist. It's actually a war zone. Providing abortion in this country is going into a militarized zone. And it's largely ignored. It's largely invisible. We're told that the fight over abortion is just some abstract sort of debate that goes on in the halls of power, and it's not that the full dimension of what it means and the actual war. And it is a bullet-ridden war. It is a war that has included 42 bombings, 182 arson attacks on clinics, over 7,000 or almost 7,000 acts of documented violence against abortion clinics in the last couple of decades. And this is something that needs to be seen. I think you can see some of it in both the violent assaults on the Planned Parenthood as well as the level of protections they had in place, which probably saved a lot of people's lives. And I think this is something that it's counter to what people think of as what this country is in terms of women's rights and women's supposed liberties in this country, to provide women reproductive care, to provide women the ability to decide for themselves when and whether to have a child, which is fundamental to women's ability to participate fully and equally in society. To do that means you are risking your life every single day.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. And Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and the initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, The Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And we're talking about the escalation of the assault against abortion and against women in general. Sansara, you know, one thing, when you were talking about the courtrooms and about the Supreme Court in particular, this is something that listeners to this show and people who've been following what Stop Patriarchy is doing, all of these people actually might have some sense of this particular court case that's coming up in the Supreme Court sooner rather than later is actually something that's been rooted in a lot of what, there's been a lot of fight around that. There's been a lot of opposition, a lot of people going out and taking a stand around that, and in very good ways. Still, for people who had some kind of, you know, hope that the Supreme Court or that the court system or that the legal system would somehow come to its senses or you'd get whatever and you'd be able to resolve this and there wouldn't be the ending of abortion clinics in Texas and there wouldn't be all this stuff going on that seems crazy on one hand, but it's actually very real and very systematically being implemented. I was really struck by something in the article that was in Revolution where it said that there's a problem that even, you know, on the one hand, if they decide in favor of the state of Texas, that's going to devastate the abortion clinics in Texas, the number of them, and it's going to make it impossible for many, many women to get abortions. It's also then the thing is, even if they don't decide not to take the case, that also leads to just immense repercussions for women. Let's talk about that legal aspect in terms of what's it really going to take. Will this actually, is this a way to change things, is by hoping that somehow the courts are going to side with us?
Well, I think it's a good question. Since 1973, since abortion was made legal with the Supreme Court case of Roe versus Wade, which was won through mass resistance and struggle and through changes that the U.S. was going through internationally and domestically and in how it wanted to portray itself in relation to women. So it wasn't like the Supreme Court just got enlightened one day and granted women these rights. It was fought for. It was won through struggle. But since then, there's been a concerted counterattack. There's been a revenge. There's been a movement to take this away. And there's been interest in the ruling class of capitalism, imperialism, to see society shored up by reasserting the traditional patriarchal family and restricting these rights of women. And so I think what we've seen is actually over decades, the Supreme Court has has ushered in a number of major decisions. I think if you look at it from a simplistic lens, and a lot of people have this false impression. They look at it and say, well, every time abortion rights are challenged, Roe v. Wade has been upheld. And that's technically true, because technically abortion is still legal. But every case that's gone to the Supreme Court, not every case, but many, many cases to the Supreme Court on abortion over the last few decades have resulted in a whittling away and an undermining of the foundation of Roe v. Wade. So you take something like the Casey decision in the 90s, it made it so it used to be the case that if you wanted to restrict abortion, the onus was on you to prove that there was an overwhelming interest in the women's health to have a restriction. They reversed that. The Supreme Court reversed it. They upheld Roe v. Wade, but they reversed the onus. And they said, no, you no longer have to prove that there's some good reason to restrict abortion or to regulate it. Instead, the people who want to provide abortion have to prove that the restrictions being passed are, quote, undue burdens on women's right to exercise abortion. So rather than there being so now you have to prove, which of course it's an undue burden. The laws that were passed in Texas are undue burdens on women. They are closing down abortion clinics, requiring medically unnecessary requirements that are forcing clinics to close if they're not mini emergency rooms, even though abortion is an outpatient simple procedure. They're forcing clinics to close if the doctors don't have admitting privileges with local hospitals, even though abortion is 10 times safer than childbirth. And you can admit a patient whether you have admitting privileges or not. So these are medically unnecessary. They're trap laws. That means that they are targeted to regulate abortion clinics in order to close them down. But instead of just being thrown away because they're garbage laws and make no sense and they harm women, instead of the onus is on the abortion clinics to prove it puts an undue burden on women. And of course, these restrictions should meet that standard and be thrown out. But even the notion that that's the standard, that's a huge restriction. And that's what's opened the doors for the restrictions we've seen in recent years, the flood of restrictions that are making mandatory waiting periods, closing down clinics if the doctors don't have admitting privileges, closing down clinics if they don't conform to many emergency room standards, forcing doctors to read medically untrue, dishonest disclaimers about abortion before a woman can get the procedure. All kinds of things which are hugely harmful to women have been allowed because of this Supreme Court decision. And I could walk through, and I won't because we don't have the time, a number of other key cases. And I think this is actually the real trajectory of the Supreme Court on this has been to corrode and corrode and undermine abortion access and abortion rights for women. And so this is where relying on these courts, relying on the politicians, relying on the political establishment, which includes Taliban-esque Christian fundamentalists and fascists on the one side, and people who want to conciliate and compromise with that on the other side, relying on that power structure has proven deadly. It's got us in a dynamic that Avakian correctly described as yesterday's outrage becomes today's compromised position and tomorrow's limit of what can be imagined. And so I know I've spoken for a while, but I think there's two major things that we need to draw from this, and I'll just say them briefly. One, there's something deep about this system and the patriarchy woven into it that is at the root, and people really do. This should be a wake-up call. The shooting in Colorado, the fact that in 2015, women's right to abortion is being terroristically revoked. This should be a wake-up call. We actually need a revolution. We need a different system. Under a new state power, with an actual revolution, day one, we could deal with these problems. This is not complicated problems. Women should have the right to abortion. You know, these are simple things to solve. There's a lot of things that take more complexity, but with state power, we could solve it. With state power, we could have no more police murdering on the street, too. We could do a lot of things. And that revolution is real, and people need to get into it. Avakian has developed a strategy and a vision and an approach to revolution, including to women's liberation as a driving force in this revolution, and as the only way we can actually break the thousands of years of tradition and intensifying oppression against women. So I really do, this should be a moment, if anything would drive you to open your eyes and say, maybe there's something else we should consider, this is where you should go. Two, we have to rely on ourselves right now from the perspective of hastening that revolution, preparing people for that revolution, waking people up and organizing people, and from the perspective of having the greatest immediate effect on stopping this fascist assault on women, there has to be massive resistance. And this is something that I've been very active in organizing and calling for. Last weekend, right as the shooting was going on, I issued a call for mass protests for abortion rights in support of abortion providers. We held them in 5 cities around the country last weekend. It was very important. But more people need to join with this. And we are mobilizing people for Roe v. Wade this year, the anniversary in January of when abortion rights were granted, for people to stand up in Washington, D.C. and in San Francisco on both coasts. And there needs to be resistance. We need to rely on ourselves, not on the courts, not on the politicians, but on people who do not want to see women enslaved. We have to go in the streets. People have to learn again and become the kind of people who are standing up and fighting to change the way people think and to beat these attacks back. It is a matter of life and death for women.
Mm-hmm. All right, Sansara, and we will have you back on to talk about these mobilizations in January because they're just that damn important, all right? And we'll have you back very soon to talk about that. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and she's the initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy. And again, if you want to get in touch with Sansara, with the Stop Patriarchy movement, you can go to stoppatriarchy.org or email stoppatriarchy@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames. And nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down.
All right, welcome back. We will not go down Gaza from Michael Hart. It's a beautiful song. Someday we're going to play the whole song because it's just that damn important. All right. You know, back earlier this week, I had the chance to interview a friend at the show and someone who's been on the show many times before, always very compelling. And she's this is Jen Marlowe. And Jen is a journalist, author, filmmaker, and human rights activist and playwright. All right. She's got a whole list of stuff she does remarkably well. And she just recently wrote an article called In Gaza, Medical Permits Linked to Intelligence Gathering. And without any further ado, I thought it was something that people need to hear about. So I talked to Jen earlier this week. And without any further ado, let's jump into that. All right. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was looking through emails and got one from a friend who, every time I see an email from this person, I know there's going to be something that's going to really, really just grab me hard. All right. And this was a thing called In Gaza, Medical Permits Linked to Intelligence Gathering. And it's a piece that was done by Jen Marlowe. And Jen is a journalist, filmmaker. She's a playwright. She's basically all around one of the busiest people I know, okay? And her work is really very, I've always found it very compelling and very important in the world today. And this piece in particular has really, again, just really grabbed me. It's about thousands of Palestinians applying for permission to leave Gaza every year, and those who are rejected say they're never told why. And then you find out that actually some of them are told why, and it's really, really outrageous. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be on your show again. Always great to be on your show.
Good. We'll do it more often. There you go. Let's jump into this because that just from that title, In Gaza, Medical Permits Linked to Intelligence Gathering, it really reeks of something out of sort of Nazi Germany in a certain sense. You know, this whole kind of where basically the humanity of people has been so just demolished and that even medical care is linked up in a commodity relationship whereby you're in order to have your physical body taken care of, you actually have to sell your soul, as it were. And to me, it's sort of really striking. Why don't you tell people what the gist of the story is?
Well, the gist of the story is that Palestinians, there's many levels and layers to the story. And so one layer is that the healthcare system in Gaza is virtually in a state of collapse. And so Palestinians in Gaza who need any kind of secondary or tertiary care, in many, many cases, that kind of care is just not available in the Gaza Strip. And so those patients need to leave Gaza Strip in order to get health care outside. And the only passenger exit to Gaza Strip that is consistently operating, consistently open, is the Erez crossing, which separates Gaza from Israel. So the patients, whether they're trying to seek medical treatment inside Israel at a hospital or in occupied East Jerusalem or in the West Bank or in Jordan, they need to exit through Erez in order to access those hospitals. And the Israeli army controls the Erez crossing. And what I discovered in the course of my reporting is that, as you mentioned, thousands of people every year, in fact, in 2014, it was over 18,000 Palestinians from Gaza applied to cross Erez for medical reasons. 80% of them did get permission, but that left over 500 of them who were denied permission to get the medical treatment. 86 of those were children. And that left nearly 3,000 of them whose treatment was delayed while they're waiting for a response. So you can imagine a patient who needs chemotherapy, it's time sensitive, a delay while missing your chemotherapy appointment and waiting sometimes for weeks or longer to get a response has an absolutely detrimental effect on your health situation. But I think that what I discovered and what I learned, and this I learned this first from talking to Physicians for Human Rights Israel, they were the first ones to tip me off about this, is that there's a number of patients every year who, before they are either given their permissions or rejected before their permission, before they're given their answer, they're called in by the Israel Security Agency, otherwise known as General Security Services or Shabak, for security interviews. And so their ability to access health care depends on whether or not they're willing to cooperate with Israeli intelligence.
Now, what does it mean, actually, you know, this point about cooperating with Israeli intelligence? What is it that they're being asked to do?
Well, there's a whole spectrum. It ranges. In 2014, there was 179 such patients who were called in for these security interviews. And in some cases, the patients report that their questions are pretty routine. They're asked about their own activities. They might be asked a little bit about their neighborhood or their relatives, sort of quote-unquote expected questions. But in other cases, it's really flat-out extortion. And they're essentially told that they have a choice. They can either collaborate with Israel and they could become an informer, a spy for Israel, or they won't get their health care that they need. And I encountered several such cases where that type of blackmail happened. Their ability to get treatment was made contingent upon whether or not they would spy for the Shabak, the Israeli intelligence agency.
And, you know, one thing, Jen, that really kind of gets at you is that this is after what we've seen over the last few years of pretty much the entire infrastructure in Gaza, including, like, this last round of the war on Gaza, so many hospitals and healthcare facilities being destroyed by Israeli bombs. And now this is added onto it where you need to get some kind of care, as you're saying, whether it's in East Jerusalem, whether it's in the occupied, you know, West Banks, or whether it's in Israel, that after medical facilities have been and doctors and personnel have been, you know, bombed, have been wounded, have been killed, and basically people are left with nothing. The only way they have, the only access they have a lot of times to actually medical care that might help them survive is now being taken away from them.
Absolutely, and that's really part of the fundamental root of the problem. The reason this is an issue at all, the reason why Palestinians need to leave Gaza in order to get health care, is because the healthcare system is in such a state of collapse. The attacks that Gaza underwent in 2014 and before that in 2012 and before that in 2009 is absolutely a part of the reason why medical facilities that were damaged or destroyed, doctors and medical personnel who were killed, but also the ongoing siege and the ongoing occupation is another reason why the healthcare system is in such a state of collapse in Gaza. Medical equipment can't get in or can't get repaired. The financial hardships that the government in Gaza is undergoing means that even basic medical supplies, gloves for doctors, medicines, things like that. I believe, if I remember correctly, the World Health Organization told me that at any one time, up to 30% of a very basic medical supplies are unavailable in Gaza. And I should check that number to make sure that that number is correct. But a very large amount of basic healthcare supplies are not available in Gaza. Doctors, because of the siege and because travel from Gaza is made nearly impossible, doctors cannot leave Gaza to attend seminars and trainings and to get their training updated and to learn new techniques, which is a very important part, of course, of modern medicine. So for all of these reasons, the healthcare situation in Gaza is abysmal. And in fact, when I was in Gaza last, which was I think about 4 months ago, a report had just been released by the United Nations, UNRWA, the United Nations Refugees Association, which said that the infant mortality rate had actually gone up in Gaza for the first time in decades. And that is a very, very troubling indicator of the collapse of the healthcare system overall. When the infant mortality rate goes up, then that's an indicator that something is very, very wrong with the healthcare system.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jen Marlowe. Jen is a filmmaker and a journalist, and we're talking about one of her more recent articles, In Gaza, Medical Permits Are Linked to Intelligence Gathering. Now, let's give people a sense of just one case in particular, and there were a few in here that you detail, and they were all very just enraging, but this one in particular I thought would be important to look at. It's the case of Hazem Saber. Can you tell people about what happened there?
Yeah, sure. Well, and even some of the most egregious details of that case I wasn't even able to include in the article just because of word length. But Hazem, and I should mention that this is not his real name, and I intentionally did not use people's real names for their own protection because that could be used against them in their ongoing attempt to try to seek medical treatment. So Hazem had applied for permission to travel to the West Bank. He had a severely damaged knee, a ruptured knee cartilage, and he had been told that he needed to report to Erez for a security interview before his request would be processed. And a few days before his interview, the first thing that happened is someone he didn't know reached out to him on Facebook and was asking him all these personal questions. And when he tried to pretend that he wasn't in Gaza and he tried to be evasive to the stranger, the stranger told him that he knew where Hazem was, he knew exactly which town he was from, and then the stranger basically asked Hazem over Facebook if he was willing to work with him in order to get his permission to leave Gaza and get his medical treatment. And Hazem assumed that the them that he was referring to was the Shabak, was the Israel Security Agency. So when the day of Hazem Saber's security interview arrived, he entered Erez. He was first taken into a room where he was strip searched. And actually, as he was being strip searched, the officer who was strip searching him essentially thrust his finger up Hazem's rectum and said he was searching for weapons, but did that very unnecessarily and very violently. Did a rectum weapon search essentially on Hazem as he entered Erez. And then Hazem was brought to an officer who Hazem was pretty sure was the same officer that investigated all of the people from his town, because usually it would be the same Israeli intelligence officer would investigate a certain area, because then they would learn all the families and all the streets and all the neighborhood. And this intelligence officer knew Hazem's entire medical history, knew everything about all the members of his family. He knew the names of Hazem's nephews. He knew which university in Russia his brother had studied. And he even knew which friend of Hazem's had been at Hazem's house the night before watching the World Cup with him. And he knew exactly what clothes that person was wearing. That was the level of intimate personal detail about Hazem that this officer already knew. There was sexual enticement that happened during the interview. A female officer had walked in and put her hand under the back of Hazem's neck and under his shirt. Hazem removed her hand. The female officer walked around in front of Hazem. This is all according to what he told me. and began to unbutton his shirt. And again, he pushed her hands away, and he very much felt the pressure that all of this was in order to try to get him to give information, and has himself that they were particularly interested in this friend, the friend who had been watching the World Cup at Hazem's home the day before, that's who they wanted Hazem to supply information about. Eventually, when Hazem made it clear that he was not going to cooperate, the officer asked to see Hazem's bad knee. So Hazem rolled up his pants leg so that the officer could see it. And then what Hazem told me was that the officer kicked his bad knee and Hazem collapsed and passed out from the pain. And when he woke up, he was back in the main terminal of the Erez crossing. His ID was returned. He left Erez, and he is, every time he's applied for permission to be able to leave Erez to get his knee treated, he was told that he's barred on security grounds, and he's never been told what the security grounds are. But he feels pretty sure that he knows the reason, which was that he didn't cooperate with the intelligence. And Hazem said he will go again for a security interview if they call him. He told me that he's got nothing to hide, but he'd rather cut his leg off at his knee than to become a collaborator and a spy.
Mm-hmm. Now, just a couple more questions here. The Israeli government, the Israel Security Agency, they actually attempted to say that this, none of this is real, none of this is true. And then they got kind of blown out of the water in an interesting way, too. Can we talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. The official response that's been given by the Israeli intelligence is saying that they do not make receipt of an entry permit into Israel contingent on whether or not a patient is willing to give information. They say that the security question is only in order to evaluate whether there's any danger posed by this applicant, him or herself, whether this applicant is a security risk, and that it's got nothing to do with intelligence gathering. But that narrative was upended last July, and this is something, again, that Physicians for Human Rights Israel turned me on to investigating, because a year earlier than that, there is an Israeli citizen who is presumed to be kidnapped in Gaza, a man named Avira Mengistu. And a representative of the Israeli Prime Minister's office was having a conversation with the family, and this conversation was televised, a conversation with this Israeli family whose son is presumed to be being held in Gaza. And the Prime Minister's representative was trying to let the family know how seriously the serious measures they were taking to try to bring safely home back Mengistu from Gaza. And as a way to show the family just how seriously they were taking it and just how much they were doing, the Prime Minister's representative said to them, when people who are relatives of Hamas managers want to come to Israel and receive medical care in Israel, we tell them, no, give us information about Mengistu. So essentially, the representative of the Prime Minister's office admitted, and this is the first actual admission that we've got from an Israeli official, admitted on television that extortion happens, and that when there are people, patients from Gaza, civilians from Gaza who need medical care, that there are times that their ability to receive that medical care is made conditional upon providing information. I believe the Prime Minister's office may not have been intended for that to be that kind of admission when he was making that statement, but in fact, that's what it is.
Well, let's talk about one more thing here, which I think is also very important, and that is the veterans of an elite Israeli intelligence unit basically standing up and disclosing the use of blackmail in the country's intelligence work, including on people in need of medical treatment outside Gaza. That was a fairly heavy action.
Oh, it was a very, very significant action and a very, very brave one on the part of the veterans of this unit. It's called Unit 8200. Which is an elite Israeli intelligence unit, and there were 43 veterans of this unit who all signed an open letter, which essentially disclosed the use of blackmail in Israel's intelligence work. And they listed many types of examples in which blackmail was used, and one of those examples included people who were in need of medical treatment outside of Gaza. And the veterans who signed that letter, they came out and they said the reason why they were coming out now is because they were refusing to continue serving as tools in deepening the military control over the occupied territories. One of these veterans from the intelligence unit revealed that he had heard a recorded intelligence interview with the Palestinian, and the Israeli officer conducting the interview had told the Palestinian he knew that this man's brother-in-law had cancer, and according to this veteran of the unit, during the interview, the Israeli intelligence officer said something like, our hospitals are good, and kept saying that over and over again, and kept referencing that the brother-in-law had cancer. And the soldier who was listening to this interview, who then signed the letter, it felt clear to him that this Israeli intelligence officer was either threatening that Palestinian or bribing him. And one of the authors of the letter who spoke to me over Skype, named Regev, he said that he felt these practices were extremely problematic because the people who are under this kind of pressure of extortion and of blackmail, they're not protected by any rights. They're ruled by a regime who does not give them any rights or any guarantees. And Regev said he does believe that Israel has security concerns and that there are aspects of intelligence work that play an important role in preventing attacks against Israeli citizens. However, he said there are many, many practices in intelligence work regarding the Palestinians that have nothing to do with defense, but have to do with maintaining and continuing the operation of the occupation and are about infiltrating all parts of Palestinian society in order to make sure the occupation continues. And because Regev did not want to be a part of continuing the operation of the occupation, that was the reason he was one of the authors of this letter and why 43 veterans of this intelligence unit signed the letter.
All right, Jen Marlowe, once again, really great work. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Sure. And tell people how they can get in touch with you, your website, all that.
I would love to stay in touch with people. My website is donkeysaddle.org, and it's Donkey Saddle Projects is the name of my organization. Folks can sign up on my email list there. They can follow me on Twitter, which is @donkeysaddle.org, and they can follow my blog as well, which is View from the Donkey Saddle.
All right. Thank you very much, Jen. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
All right. Take care now. Bye.
Bye.
All right, we were just talking with Jen Marlowe, and she's an author, filmmaker, human rights activist, and playwright, and she recently wrote an article called In Gaza, Medical Permits Linked to Intelligence Gathering. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was The Day After Tomorrow, and it's from, I think it's Live On Earth Climate Alliance, or maybe it's Live On Earth Climate Alliance, but it's a hell of a song, The Day After Tomorrow, because that's the big question right now. Is there actually going to be a day after tomorrow? All right. Just last week, as I was searching around and just investigating and looking for stuff to study about this climate conference in Paris and what's at stake there and what's going on and who's doing what and who's saying what and what the hell are we going to come out of it with? I actually stumbled onto something that really, really intrigued me. And it was a letter. It was an open letter from academics to world leaders ahead of the Paris Climate Conference 2015. And it was a letter that was signed by 2,500 academics and others. And I was really intrigued by that. And I wanted to find out who was behind it, who had something to say about it. And I found him. His name is Lawrence Torcello. And Lawrence is an assistant professor of philosophy at Rochester Institute of Technology. Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Well, why don't you tell people what this open letter from academics to world leaders ahead of the Paris Climate Conference is?
Sure. Well, this is an idea I've been kicking around for quite a while. It's the idea that maybe there should be an open letter, not in particular from academics in general, but from philosophers and ethicists. And a few weeks ago, another professor of philosophy, Keith Horton from the University of Wollongong, contacted me and some other philosophers who had written on climate change and telling us about the Global Climate Change Week Initiative, which was an effort to get academics to teach about climate change between October 19th and 25th or organize community things to inform people about climate change. And I thought this is a good opportunity to maybe start such an open letter. but why not, you know, extend it beyond just philosophers and ethicists? I think academics have something to say about climate change that's important, and also is something that's such a broad problem. It affects almost all of academic fields. So all of us have something, or in some sense are impacted by climate change.
Well, one of the things that really struck me, Lawrence, is actually, and it's very heavy, this whole point of when you said you started out as an open letter from philosophers and then spread it to other academics and whatnot, philosophers and ethicists. And I thought that was really important because it's so rare that people would think, you know, that people even approach it from the standpoint of, well, there's an ethical question here. There's a moral question here. And it's actually a fairly heavy one. I wanted to, you know, ask you about that, how you came to that consideration, because this is something that's, you know, it's particularly, look, if you're going to rely on the people that are actually at that conference, and you're going to look at all this, and you're not going to learn from Copenhagen, you're not going to learn from all the what these people are actually doing there, and how they're, even when they go in, they went in basically with, well, this is our position, and it was nowhere near what needed to be done to actually save the planet. So let's talk about this thing, about the imperative you felt for ethicists and philosophers to weigh in on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I mean, one of the things I've been very surprised with since I've been involved with the topic of climate change is how often people will say something similar to what you just said, that they haven't really been thinking about this from an ethical point of view. And as a philosopher, as a moral philosopher, I mean, it seems like this is an obvious ethical problem. And I don't know any ethicist who's taken seriously, professional ethicist who doesn't think this is perhaps the greatest or among the greatest ethical challenges that we face. And I mean, all the pieces of the puzzle are there for it to be the greatest ethical challenge we face. Those who are most vulnerable to climate change are exactly the people who are least responsible for climate change. They're also the people who are least capable of adapting to climate change. Climate change is something that's going to affect not only human beings, but other species on this planet. So it brings in the issue of animal welfare. It brings in the issue of what we owe future generations. And frankly, what we've allowed to happen already counts as a great moral failure on our part, because even if we were to act very aggressively right now, the best case scenario is going to leave unfair devastation and parts of the world that are most vulnerable and least able to cope with it. So poverty-stricken areas like the low coastal regions of Bangladesh, they're going to be affected greatly already by climate change. Low-lying island nations are already on the way to displacement from climate change. So best-case scenario, a lot of the very most poor and vulnerable in the world are already harmed by what we've allowed to happen. So it's not only a challenge, it's in some sense already an ethical failure on the part of humanity.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I found very interesting in some of the stuff that you've written is actually this point about that it's not just people taking a stand in relation to this. That's extremely important. But there actually is a need for this to, as you're talking about, for climate policy must involve consistently weighing the actions of affluent industrialized nations against their impacts on the least advantaged, which is what you're getting at. Mm-hmm. And then looking at this thing, though, of that basically this is, you know, it's not like there's sort of, this is only, we'll put it this way, it's not like you're just saying, okay, well, we just have to take a stand, but you're actually arguing for people to do something about this. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, because that's actually looking at what's going on at this conference and what's going on in these other conferences, and the whole idea that it's sort of people scurrying around and trying to sort of get the best deal for themselves. The need to actually stand up and recognize, as you put it in something recently, or maybe it was in the letter itself, where you said it's an issue of such ethical magnitude that being on the correct side of history becomes a signifier of moral character for generations to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I firmly believe it. This is one of those issues that, to the degree that we have generations in the future looking back to see what happened at this time on the planet, this is going to be one of those issues like slavery, like the Holocaust, where you look to see where did certain people stand, and that tells you a great deal about their character, their ethical character. And I think this is one of those issues that are going to be, that has to be used and will be used by future generations to sort of gauge the ethical climate of the present moment. And yeah, it's justice requires that any of these negotiations, like the one in Paris, be entered into with the interests of the most vulnerable people in mind. that's the only way to make sure that there's fairness and justice at play in these climate negotiations.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lawrence Torchello. Lawrence is an assistant professor of philosophy at Rochester Institute of Technology, and he's also the co-author of the Open Letter from Academics to World Leaders Ahead of the Paris Climate Conference. And this letter was signed by 2,500 academics, and we're talking with Lawrence about the moral challenge of climate change. You know, one of the things that you said as well, which is interesting too, because I think this whole point of actually really approaching it from this, really refreshingly approaching it from this stand of sort of, look, we're talking morals and ethics here. This is actually important, you know? And it's sort of like what defines human existence in a certain sense in terms of your, you know, you can be completely unethical, you can be completely whatever, just to hell with everything, and we're going for, you know, which frankly is so much of the world is today. You know, it's like the drive for profit and beating each other out and everything else. And people as humans get pushed down, pushed under, their throats cut, basically. But you make this, it's interesting because you make this thing of, and I thought this was coming right at the point where you say, look, the members of the industrialized world should shoulder a shared moral responsibility for the ongoing consequences of our current behavior. We have long understood how to curb global warming through carbon pricing agreements, but we've postponed action time and time again. And actually, that was something that I think people don't actually see that pose that way, where actually there's a moral responsibility for the ongoing consequences of current behavior.
Mm-hmm. People approach these things and you hear terms like carbon budget thrown around, but there's a moral budget at play here too. And every time we postpone action, I mean, we're leaving less of a margin for error for future generations, and we're getting ourselves greater and greater moral implication into the injustice of the situation. Absolutely, we've already failed. I mean, as I was saying, if everything works out as best as it possibly can now, people on this planet are still going to be dying from climate change-related events. And that's something that I think that we haven't collectively reconciled ourselves with. I don't think any of us fully understand the ramifications of climate change. It hasn't collectively entered our consciousness so that every decision we make politically, for instance, is made with its ramifications for climate change in play. We're not used to thinking along these terms. We've evolved as a species morally to consider things of ethical importance when we can see the results right before our eyes and we can see it affecting our community. But climate change is a case where we're unintentionally harming other people on the other side of the world very often that we're never going to meet with things like driving our car or turning up the thermostat. And that's a way of thinking that we haven't come to terms with yet, but that's how we're going to have to start thinking. I often think of the moral response needed against climate change is akin to the collective mobilization on the home front during World War II. Everybody has to be involved from the top down and from the bottom up. And in fact, if you look at many of the things that citizens were asked to do during World War II, they're all things that would help a great deal in reducing and limiting our carbon emissions. Things like, you know, rationing, things like planting gardens, eating locally, commuting, all of these things. You know, I often say that we should be talking about planting victory forests. But no political leaders are really telling us that right now.
Right, but somebody like Jim Henson is.
Yeah,
we need reforestation,
which is why he's very much needed. Yeah, he's one of the few people out there who isn't afraid to say, no, this is much more serious than we're admitting and that any of our leaders are leading us on to say.
You know, one thing, and I think we have time for like just a short answer on this, but I'll try to make the question as short as possible, but it's more common. And it really is, you know, when you look at this stuff of particularly ethicists and philosophers coming up and saying this and laying this out, there is a point, like when you were talking about an example, I would actually, for myself, I would like to think more of when you think about people, morality actually determining what people did with their lives and how they stood in relation to what their government was doing, to what was going on in the world, was more shaped by the 1960s in a certain sense, where you actually had people come up and take a stand based on ethics and morality and taking responsibility for the crimes that were being committed by their own governments around the world and really fighting to stop that. I wanted to know what you thought of that, but then also, how has the response been to what you've been doing?
Well, one, yeah, I think, you know, as I say in one of the pieces I wrote in The Conversation recently about this letter, at the very end of it, I think we're going to make progress on climate change when and if we begin to think about it ethically and take seriously our ethical obligations. And other than that, we're going to keep, you know, punting on this. We're going to keep, you know, twiddling our thumbs. And so, yes, this idea that we have to actually stand up and be ethically responsible, I think, is the key to solving this. The response to the letter has been pretty positive. I've been very pleased with the number of academics and some very eminent academics who have come out in support of this letter. And people like yourself inviting me on to talk about this letter, it's all been really, really positive, I think. And I think the more we're exposed to these things and the more we hear from others that, you know, this is an important issue, this is an ethical issue, the more this is going to elevate the awareness of, you know, your average citizen, which is really necessary, as you know, I'm sure, to really muster the political and ethical action necessary.
All right, Lawrence, unfortunately, we're going to have to run now, but thank you very much for joining us today. And keep it up, man. Keep it up.
Thank you. This is very important.
All right, take care now. Bye.
Bye.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor, Jen Marlowe, and Lawrence Torcello. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my intern, Alex Brenner, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at my new email address, which is mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. I really look forward to hearing from each and every one of you. We're going to go out now with a song that seems to fit the whole theme of today's show, and it's Revolution from The Pretenders. Talk to you again next week.
Cats like me and you have got lost, but they adhere to laws outside the laws and say down by those we don't subscribe to. The world is getting changed.